English, the English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest. The English are noble, the English are nice, and worth any other at double the price. The English are moral, the English are good, and clever and modest and misunderstood. The English, the English, the English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest. Typical English understatement.
That's supposed to be ironic. Honest, well, sort of. British humour, ironic and otherwise, is the topic of my Sharon Hour, just starting. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And I have with me a fellow Brit, the director of the Laguna Art Museum here in town, Malcolm Warner, to review the kind of comedy shows we grew up with in the 60s and 70s in England. British humour isn't just ironic. It can be musical, very often. It can be camp, also very often is. It can be subtle, nuanced, referential, though rarely reverential. And it can be puerile, full of laughs and snot and farts. But what it is, inevitably, ineffably, invariably, quintessentially, recognisably, is British. And in England's case, often emanating from the smartest, youngest minds at universities like Oxford and Cambridge.
The reviews came out of universities always, and I, in a way, it's similar here. I know the Ivies all have their reviews, you know, Harvard has Hasty Pudding, Princeton has Triangle, and I know that the most loved stuff that really everybody waited for throughout the show was the kick line, where all the men, because it was still mainly all male, and so it was an all-male kick line dressed as female chorus girls, and they love that here. In England, we always love that too.
In high school, I was in a 17th century comedy called Epicene by Ben Jonson, where I was this camp Kenneth Williams style character called Sir Amorous Lafool. That's something I haven't thought about for a long time. I remember a kind of flouncy demeanour and effeminate pink costumes.
So you're
it's
in
funny
drag.
How, yeah, campness, a camp kind of mannerisms were so much part of comedy, aren't they, in England?
In that era. It was in the 50s, 60s, because homosexuality wasn't overt. Homosexuality was literally a crime.
Yeah.
In England, you could be imprisoned.
Right.
It wasn't ever associated with being it was associated with being homosexual, but in a benign...
Yeah, not by everyone. I mean, my mum, for example, I remember her saying about this comedian Frankie Howard, who had the most outrageous, campy kind of manner as part of his performance. She said, there's something a bit funny about that Frankie Howard.
What is a camp performance?
Well, I believe the word camp has actually found its way into the addenda of the OED.
I beg your pardon?
It's found its way into the addenda of the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, and it's defined there as that which is fundamentally frivolous. And I suppose that's about the nearest you'd get to an academic definition of it. What I think the general, you know, current interpretation of the word is always that which is verging on the effeminate, you know, that sort of thing, which is ludicrous to say that about me because I've personified what you might call the butch element in light entertainment some time now.
Yes, indeed.
Kenneth Williams was one of the first camp comics to gain national notoriety thanks to his partnership with Hugh Paddick as Julian and Sandy, a pair of chorus boy duckies on the Sunday afternoon radio show Round the Horn. Jules and Sand were so far out of the closet that they couldn't have got back in without a long-haul flight. Their banter was gay in all senses of the word, even employing the camp slang language of Polari. But to the home audience, listening in their millions, Julian and Sandy were nothing more than a pair of charmingly amusing nice boys.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy.
Oh, hello, Mr.
The whole country would stop and get home for like half past one Sunday lunchtime or whatever and work their dinner and the pub and everything around it.
And we sat round listening to this every single Sunday, same time every Sunday, and we used to laugh at it, and none of us could have known what it meant.
Oh, yes, we're filling in as photographers between acting engagements on the telly. We just had this one where I'm all dragged up as a sultan.
And there's me stood at his side wearing a pair of great baggy trousers and full of Eastern promise.
The campness in Julian and Sandy was all in the Polari.
Polari is like, I guess Cockney was, a form of slang that was used by the gay subculture and also by all sorts of underworld types, criminals, prostitutes, fairground people, and around the 60s, the drug subculture. It has a little rhyming slang and some Yiddish. Here are a few words. Bona means good. Eek means face. Naff means dull. Nanti is not. Vada is sea. Omi is man. Might get you started in doing your own translations of what's going on here in this British comedic pairing of Kenneth Williams and Hugh Paddock, though a lot is just inference with funny-sounding made-up words. Their alter egos were called Julian and Sandy, and gays and straights alike gathered to listen to them every Sunday, as I hope you will, dear listeners, to my Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Dedicated tonight to the comedy shows in Britain in the 50s and 60s and 70s, their personality, and a little bit about why they were how they were.
It was freeness, the fact that they sounded so free and easy, and they're in this their own little world in the middle of stiff Britain.
Paddock and I used to play Jewel and Sam, and we used to come in, and Kenneth Horne was always eminently reasonable with these two. They used to come in and say, "Oh, Miss Rawne, oh, Bernard Vardy, your jolly old eek, oh, Miss Rawne. Bona Tavardi, a dolly old eek again."
Thank you very much. Bona Tavardi, a dolly old eek. How could they possibly have known what that meant? How could any of us have known what that meant?
How Bona Tavardi, a dolly old eek just means how nice to see your face again.
We are poised at a moment in history. The future could be naff.
Naff.
Or it could be Bona.
Bona.
That was gay men's means of communicating for quite some time in public.
The majority of people listening to the Old Home Service would never, ever have thought what was going on in that language. And indeed, if the BBC knew, they'd have closed down in shame.
Let us put our best lally forward and with our eeks shining with hope, stroll together towards the fantabulosa futurette.
Round the Horn made Kenneth Williams a household name at around the same time that the Carry On films were hitting their stride in the early 60s, in his life as in his art. Kenneth Williams was 9/10 sexually repressed steam, barely contained by 1/10 of a man's body.
He is in many ways asexual.
He doesn't want the fat woman, you know, it's as simple as you want it to be.
Don't rush me. I think you'll find it's worth waiting for.
Yeah, so it's Christmas, but you won't find me stuffing your turkey.
You know, everything had to be very clean and nice and proper.
And this sort of exaggerated bitchiness that he had.
The way Kenneth Williams would speak, and is often the way with camp people, their words come out of their mouth, unashamedly dressed in mink and mules.
I always keep my vowels open, you see. lovely vowel sounds, aren't they? I've got the diction, you see. I have got it. Oh, even at drama school, they used to say, "You've got the diction, Kenny. Go on, show us your diction." My father's a cockney. He didn't talk like me at all. No, he hated my kind of talk. He always said, "What are you going around with a plough in your mouth for? Talk like that for? Putting it on, giving yourself airs." Well, I wasn't giving myself airs at all, I think.
Many people thought that camp comedy's time had come and gone, but it still lives and breathes with all the variety that is the spice of camp life.
What sort of a school did you go to, Mr. Humphreys?
Mixed.
Oh, yeah, girls and boys?
No, just boys.
Are you being served? Or, you know, I mean, that was completely camp.
Carry On movies, too.
But maybe that was a product of single-gender education.
In that high school production of Epicene, I brought a bold, adventurous new twist to the situation, because my character was not gay. Sir Amorous La Foule is just a dandy, a kind of would-be ladies man.
Just a reminder here that you're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking to Malcolm Warner, who's the director of the Laguna Art Museum, but also a compatriot from England. We're exploring the nature of the English comedy shows of our day. That last bit I played was a clip from the very campy Are You Being Served, which made it across the Atlantic and actually was popular here in America too. Though camp seems a quintessentially English tradition, even now, particularly amongst talk show hosts, think James Corden, it's possibly a reflection of English boys of our generation spending their entire youth, really up till 18, in single-sex schools. Schools tended to be segregated.
I don't know if you went to an all-boys prep.
Yeah, I went to an all-boys grammar school. For me, that was Aldershot, just outside London. That was my hometown. Grammar school, of course, means something different in the English context. It was a high school, basically.
I went to an all-girls grammar school.
And we turned out okay.
Who knows whether we did or not. I know English men really had a hard time with women because they really didn't meet them till they were 18 years old.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
There's a tremendous vulnerability to camp. Underneath the often shrieking self-assurance of it, there is this double fear. First of all, of a man's world, and I've never seen any reason why anyone should do anything except fear the man's world, and also of women themselves.
Oh, I nearly forgot. You're male.
Yes, I am, and I can prove it. Do you hear? Prove it!
Extravagant excess. That's the very heart of campery. The great camp comics have always known how to make an entrance. They'd demand a 45-piece orchestral play-on, 10 gallons of dry ice, a staircase and a line of showgirls just to pop into Tesco's for a pair of kippers. What does camp actually mean?
I woke up this morning and I felt as limp as a vicar's handshake.
Mr. Humphreys, are you free?
I'm busy pricing my ties, Captain Peacock.
The gentleman wishes to try on a dress.
I'm free.
I think camp humour is very simplistic. It's what you see is what you get. And on the whole, it's a very unthreatening humour.
I opened the door in my dressing gown. I'm not going to say it. It is a funny place to have a door.
Camp covers lots of areas. It goes from the very vulgar, I suppose, to the very subtle.
You say potato, I say potato. You say tomato, I say tomato. Potato, tomato, tomato, potato. Let's call the whole thing off.
These comic musical performers, that's such an important component of comedy in England, really, when you think about it. Maybe a bit different from the States, where there's this tradition, perhaps going back to the music halls, of comedians who sing or do
yes.
parody songs, comical yeah. songs.
You didn't have to sing Glamorous LeFou.
No, no. It's somewhat like a Shakespeare comedy, really. A lot of incomprehensible language that I'm sure all the parents laughed politely at without even understanding a word of it.
Incomprehensible language also seemed to be part of comedy back then, didn't it? I mean, the Goons had completely their own language.
Mm-hmm.
Keep that up, keep up,
keep up,
keep up,
keep up, keep
up,
Zing-dang, 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 zing-dang
bad time, is it, Echo?
Just a minute, I got it written down here on a piece of paper. A nice man wrote the time down for me this morning.
Ah, then why do you carry it around with you, Echo?
Well, if anybody asks me the time, I can show it to them.
Wait a minute, Echo, my good man.
What is it, fellow?
It's written on this bit of paper. What is 8 o'clock, is written.
I know that, my good fellow. When I asked a fellow to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then, supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
Well, how do you know when it's 8 o'clock?
I got it written down on a piece of paper.
You should get one of them things my granddad's got.
Oh.
His firm gave it to him when he retired.
Oh.
One of them things, what it is, that wakes you up at 8 o'clock, boils the kettle, and pours a cup of tea.
Oh, yeah. What's it called?
My grandma.
Oh, wait a minute. How does she know when it's 8 o'clock?
She got it written down on a piece of paper.
The surreal comedy of Spike Milligan.
Yeah, Spike Milligan, I don't know if his name really travelled across the Atlantic, but for us in England, he was such a major comedian and influence.
That was Malcolm Warner, the director of the Laguna Art Museum, who's my guest on KX935's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, tonight, featuring British comedy of the 50s, 60s, 70s, an era during which a show called The Goons, formed by Spike Milligan and including Harry Secombe and Peter Sellers, was very popular. So was Spike himself, as this clip from a tribute to him, a kind of Lifetime Achievement Award, will attest.
I was going to say about bloody time. I'm not going to thank anybody because I did it all on my own.
That's great. I have someone to mention more before you guys go. Right.
Spike, I'm sure everyone knows that you have fans from all walks of life, and of course there's one very famous, very well-respected fan in particular who wanted to be here, couldn't be here, but wanted to send a message.
These are a series of clichés you've made.
Well, that's my job this evening. Here we go, I have a letter to read out to you from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales.
Do I kneel down for this?
I'm in enough trouble already, I'm not going to say a word.
And the Prince of Wales?
Prince of Wales. I'm sorry I have to do this. I know it takes a lot of the impact out of it, but here we go. As someone who grew up to the sounds of the Goon Show on the steam-driven wireless, I must confess that I've been a lifelong fan of the participants in the show, and particularly of Spike Milligan.
Oh, the little grovelling bastard.
Okay. Anyway, and particularly of Spike Milligan, whose wonderfully original humour has always reduced me to helpless hysterics. He loves you. Spike Milligan, ladies and gentlemen. Spike Milligan.
Spike Milligan actually went to Prince Charles's wedding, to Princess Di, which is very unusual for a non-aristocrat to attend such a formal occasion. That's how much Prince Charles loved and appreciated him. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. I have with me British compatriot, Laguna Art Museum's own Malcolm Warner. Malcolm and I are discussing English comedy tonight and the kind of, let's face it, often as not, puerile humour of our day, the Goons, Monty Python, and why that may be peculiarly English.
Maybe it's habitual avoidance of serious talk about feelings out of some kind of embarrassment, which all gets channeled into comedy.
Yeah, I think that's...
I'm not the first person to say that, of course, but I think that's what John Cleese says. You know, that English comedy is a, a form of being a bit screwed up and not being able to talk about things in a serious way.
So a reaction to repression. But why does the repression exist in the first place, you think, the emotional repression? Because it doesn't exist here so much, right? People are very happy to talk about their feelings here, by and large.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It definitely inspires the comedy, or did in the comedy back then. And back then it was just being as goofy as you could. And some of it is really dated. But the surrealism was what made it distinctive. One thing I remember from The Goon, Min and Eccles. Min, the cat wants to go out. How do you know Eccles? Because it's got its hat and coat on.
Yes, stupid.
Just things that you really wouldn't go then, naturally. They took you to odd places, I think. That was what was so fun about them.
Do you think the comedy was like an outlet for English people to be a little bit more outrageous than they dared to be as part of their actual real-life personality?
I don't think so, because you're supposed to be outrageous if you're English. I mean, they just, they really, aren't you?
Eccentric.
I mean, they really court eccentricity. Mm. They're not the conventional race. Mm. So maybe it was an expression of your Englishness, an expression of your eccentricity, to make yourself acceptable in a funny way. The opposite of what it would be elsewhere, a release from convention. And I think that's one of the best things about the English, that they're not conventional.
Yes.
And that they don't admire conventionality. Although, in some ways, they are very rigid, still in terms of the class structure. You mentioned we both went to grammar schools, you know, which is immediately boxes us into a certain middle class category.
Yeah.
So they're still very imperialistic. Although they look down on the Queen because she's German. So you met the Queen?
Yeah, I was involved in an exhibition about an artist that she's very keen on because he was a painter of horses, George Stubbs. So we did this show, which was a retrospective of his work as a painter of horses. And she lent a few paintings to it because the Royal Collection contains a lot of Stubbs's works. And not only that, very unusually for her, she agreed to come and open the exhibition officially on its opening day. So I was kind of the outside curator of the show. I was actually working for another museum, not for the National Gallery, where the Stubbs show was. Anyway, so I and different people from the National Gallery got to show her and the Duke of Edinburgh around. She couldn't have been more gracious and appreciative.
Really? So,
yeah.
And what was he like?
A little bit grumpy.
Was he?
Complaining about the size of the font of the labels on the wall next to the paintings. Because he couldn't read them very well.
He has to have his say about everything, doesn't he?
Anyway, they were both very nice. It was great to have them there to kick off the show. Anthony Blunt, who for a good part of his career was the Queen's, he was called the Surveyor of the Queen's Pictures, which means paintings curator for the Royal Collection. The head of the Courtauld in my time later became very famous because he was unmasked as a Russian spy. But when he was the head of my college, he was known as Sir Anthony Blunt. He was later stripped of his knighthood. Yes. After he was exposed, he was the subject of quite a few plays and TV dramatizations and all that. And none of them got it quite right from the way that we knew him as his students. For example, he tended to be depicted always as this kind of very superior, dandified character, immaculately dressed, you know, with a carnation in a buttonhole sort of thing, because that was perhaps the way that English people wanted to see this snobby guy. But actually, he was much more of a shambling, tweedy guy with leather arm patches who was really quite affable and friendly to everyone. I mean, I'm not defending anything he did, because he probably did some awful things as a spy, but the personality that they foisted onto him in the fictionalized accounts of his life was a little bit off. I mean, that must be the, now I think of it, the fountain origin of all those songs, really, wasn't it? That Gilbert and Sullivan's song must have been the first time that anyone put that kind of very sophisticated, ironic twist on a mock patriotic song. Like
Gilbert and Sullivan was what?
Victorian.
You're listening to Malcolm Warner, who's the director of the Laguna Art Museum and my guest on tonight's Sharon R, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. He was just talking about the spy, Sir Anthony Blunt, who was the head of the Courtauld Institute where Malcolm studied art originally in London. But it's actually our shared English heritage in relation to comedy shows of our youth that's the topic on tonight's Share An Hour. And I'm going to be sharing more of those shows with you. Shows like The Goons, Pete and Dud, Monty Python.
When we were in high school going into college, Monty Python was huge. I mean, we thought of them always in a religious way, really. As, you know, whenever you assessed how well you'd done in some conversation, it was always with reference to what would John Cleese have said? What would Michael Palin have done? They were like the yardstick of not just humour, but lifestyle.
Ironically for John Cleese, it was what would Spike Milligan have said? John Cleese's Monty Python was a direct descendant of Spike Milligan's The Goons. The Goons consisted not just of Spike Milligan, but also Harry Secombe and Peter Sellers of Pink Panther fame. They were comedic icons for all of us back then, including John Cleese.
These were my childhood heroes.
Blue buff, you little devil! What were you doing up my trousers?
A man has to do what he has to do.
I became almost obsessed with them. And I'm glad that I did, because many years later I was able to understand the audience response to Monty Python in a way that I would never have done if I hadn't been such a fan of that show.
It was rather like hearing Elvis Presley doing Heartbreak Hotel for the first time. You knew this was very, very different. And it wasn't just that my father sort of looked askance at the radio when he heard it. It was that there was something in the form of it that was different.
That tricycle against the wall, whose is it?
Mine. A present from an admirer.
Could you drive into town on it?
Oh, the tricycle isn't mine. The wall was the present.
Well, drive me there on that.
Right, hold tight.
Spike Milligan was basically a surrealist.
He was, yeah. And I love what he has written on his tombstone too. Do you know that?
What's that?
I told you I was sick.
You're tuned to The Share An Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm talking tonight with Laguna's Malcolm Warner about the kind of humour we grew up with in our youth in England. The Goons, Monty Python, was sort of comfortingly childlike, goofy, prepubescent even. It included the humour of repetition that kids love and we adults can get hysterically mesmerised by.
And these are my knights of the round table. Whose castle is this?
This is the castle of my master, Guido Luamba.
Go and tell your master that we have been charged by God with a sacred quest. If he will give us food and shelter for the night, he can join us in our quest for the Holy Grail.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'll be very keen. He's already got one, you see.
What? He says they've already got one. Are you sure he's got one?
Oh, yes, it's very nice, sir.
I told him we already got one.
Well, can we come up and have a look?
Of course not. You are English type, sir.
Well, what are you then?
I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king?
What are you doing in England?
Mind your own business.
If you will not show us the Grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
What a strange us? Now look here, my good man.
I don't want to talk to you no more, you empty-headed animal food trough whopper. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. Now go away or I shall taunt you a second time.
Right.
George!
God be praised. Almighty God, we thank thee that thou hast vouchsafed to us the most holy.
Jesus Christ!
Hello, daffy English kniggets and Monsieur Arthur King, who has the brain of a duck, you know. So, we French fellows are with you a second time.
How dare you profane this place with your prince? I command you, in the name of the Knights of Camelot, to open the doors of this sacred castle to which God himself has guided us.
How you English say, one more time, Max. Unplug my nose in your direction, sons of a window dresser. You think you could out-clever us French folk with your silly knees bent running about advancing behavior? I'll wave my private parts at your aunties, you cheesy lot of second-hand electric donkey bottom biters.
In the name of the Lord, we demand entrance to this sacred castle.
No chance, English bedwetting types. I burst my pimples at you and call your door-opening request a silly thing. You tiny-brained whappers of other people's bottoms.
Perfect example of the kind of English comedic silliness embodying the dim-witted and yet arrogant Englishman who didn't quite have a handle on what was really going on. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were to pick up on that. I'm going to play you a bit of them now as part of this KX935's The Share in Our Show tonight on British comedy.
Yes, Father?
A cup of tea in here for you, if you'd like one.
It's very kind of you, sir, but I've just come in from Raga and I'm a bit grubby. I think I ought to go and have a shower first, sir.
Well, pour me a cup. There's a good chap, would you?
Certainly, sir. Yes, of course.
Thank you. How was school today?
Oh, much as usual. Thank you, sir, but I caught someone having a crafty smoke behind the wooden buildings. Had to give him rather a ticking off. Such a filthy habit, you know, sir.
It's a filthy habit, Roger. Yes.
There we are, sir. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Roger?
Yes, sir?
Sit down. Roger, your mother and I were having a bit of a chat the other day, and she thought it might be a good idea if I was to have a bit of a chat with you.
A bit of a chat, sir?
A bit of a chat, yes, Roger, just a bit of a chat.
What about, sir?
Well, there's nothing to be worried about, Roger. It's just that, to be perfectly frank, how old are you?
Well, to be perfectly frank, sir, I'm coming up to 18.
Just coming up to 18?
Well, on the verge.
On the verge of 18. Yes, well, I thought it might be a good idea to have a bit of a chat now, because I remember from my own experience that it was when I was just, coming up to 18.
On the verge.
On the verge of it. That I first began to take a serious interest in the opposite number. Now, I don't know, Roger, if you know anything about the method whereby you came to be brought about.
Well, sir, some of the boys at school say very filthy things about it, sir.
This is what I was worried about, and this is why I thought I'd have a bit of a chat and explain absolutely frankly and openly the method whereby you and everybody in this world came to be. Roger, in order for you to be brought about, it was necessary for your mother and I to do something. In particular, it was necessary for your mother, to sit on a chair, which I had recently vacated and which was still warm from my body. And then something very mysterious, rather wonderful and beautiful happened. And sure enough, 4 years later, you were born. Now, there's nothing unhealthy about this, Roger. There's nothing unnatural. It's a beautiful thing in the right hands, and there's no need to think less of your mother because of it. She had to do it, she did it, and here you are.
Well, sir, it's very kind of you to tell me. One thing actually slightly alarms me. I was sitting in this very chair yesterday, sir, and I vacated it, and the cat sat on it while it was still warm. Should we have it destroyed?
It's a lovely chair, Roger.
No, the cat, sir.
Destroy it? No, no, Roger, you don't understand. This thing of which I speak can only happen between two people who are married. And you're not married.
Not yet anyway, sir.
Not to the cat in any case. Well, Roger, now you have this knowledge about chairs and warmth, I hope you'll use it wisely.
Sir.
And take no notice of your school friends or what Uncle Bertie may say.
Dirty Uncle Bertie, they call him.
Dirty Uncle Bertie, and they're right, Roger. You know, if it hadn't been for your mother, Roger, I don't know where we'd have been. She's the only person who can really cope with Uncle Bertie. She's the only one who can really deal with him. I don't know if you realize this, Roger, but your mother even has to sleep in the same bed as Uncle Bertie to prevent him getting up to anything in the night. If only there were more people like your mother, Roger.
Well, I'm very pleased that you've told me this, sir, because, as I say, I'm very glad I don't have to believe all those filthy things that the boys at school say. And only yesterday, Uncle Bertie said to me...
Take no notice of Uncle Bertie, Roger. He's a sick, sick man, and we should feel sorry for him.
Well, I'll try, sir. Well, thank you, sir. I wonder if I should take a cup of tea up to Mother while it's still...
I wouldn't do that, Roger. She's upstairs at the moment, coping with Uncle Bertie.
Poor Uncle Bertie.
Poor Uncle Bertie.
The comedy pairing of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore was later to transition into their working class alter egos, Pete and Dud. Just to remind you, you're listening to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm here tonight with Laguna Art Museum's Malcolm Warner because we both grew up in England in approximately the same era, though he's several years younger. And this was the kind of comedy that had us rolling in the aisles.
So let's explain the whole Pete and Dud concept. This is sort of a working class...
Yeah, they wear plastic macs, don't they?
They're simulating working class sort of ignoramuses who actually know a little bit about something.
Yeah, just enough to sound ridiculous, I suppose, yeah. And Dud is a little bit less... well-informed than Pete, right? So Pete's able to contradict...
Neither of them are terribly well-informed, but they have little snippets of educated knowledge about something.
Yeah. I suppose it's poking fun at pretentiousness, really, because they've got a little touch of pretension about them.
Definitely.
Modest though they may be in this social hierarchy.
The Himalayan bee hibernates for 12 months a year. Underground in the foothills of the Andes. The bee hunts in pears and other fruits for sustenance and has a somewhat savage nature. Unlike normal bees, it produces beef extract and is worshipped by a tribe of unbelievably stupid pygmies.
Okay, cutting it off there in the interests of time, but that's kind of an intro to the standard setup of a Pete and Dud sketch where they're meeting in some highfalutin place where Pete can expound on his often faulty knowledge to Dud. Pete and Dud was the evolution of the comedy partnership of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, where they played these working class semi-ignoramuses, or ignoramai. Anyway, in honour of Malcolm Warner, who is director of the Laguna Art Museum here in town, and my guest on tonight's KX935's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, I'm going to remove us from the Zoological Gardens to an art gallery where Pete and Dud are meeting. But first, on a brief non-comedic note, let's hear from Malcolm Warner about his forays into art museums that were to provide the impetus for his future career.
When I actually started to see art for real, it was when I was old enough to go up to London, which was a short train ride, but really I didn't ever go there, even though it was, you know, 45 minutes away, until I was like 16, 17, when I'd start occasionally going up there. You know, I'd love to have been part of swinging London like you were, but I was from non-swinging Aldershot. But anyway, the reason to go up there was because I really had got to like art, and I started going to the National Gallery occasionally, and what I really loved when I saw them in the flesh were portraits, you know, portraits of particular people from hundreds of years before, often, because I thought it was just so amazing that they were so much of a human presence, and it was a way of feeling like you were in communication with, in some sense, with people who'd lived in previous historical epochs.
Hey! Hey! Hey, yeah? Oh, look, there you are. What do you mean, Judge? I've been looking for you for the last half hour. We said we'd meet in front of the Flemish masters. No, we didn't, Dad. We never said anything of the sort. When I last saw you, you were in the Pissarro, weren't you?
That's right.
Well, I said I'd meet outside the abstracts. We'd go through the old Greco, up the Van Eyck, and I'd see you in front of the bloody Rubin.
I said I was going to go round the Velasquez, through the abstracts, up the impressionists, and then in front of the Flemish masters.
No, you didn't, Dad.
It doesn't matter anyway. You know, Pete, I reckon there's a lot of rubbish in this gallery, you
really,
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only rubbish, Dad, there's a lot of muck about. Yeah. I've been looking all over the place for something good.
Yeah. What I can't understand, frankly, Pete, is that there's not a Vernon Ward gallery in here.
There's not a duck in the building. There's no Peter Scott, there's no Vernon Ward, not a duck to be seen.
Nothing. No. And a marvellous thing about Vernon Ward is, of course, he's been doing ducks all his life.
Well, he's done more ducks than you've had hot breakfast, Dad. Vernon Ward, he's done plenty of ducks. If he's done anything, he's done ducks.
Yeah. He's done ducks in all positions.
The thing what makes you know that Vernon Ward is a good painter, if you look at his ducks, have you ever looked at his ducks?
Yeah.
If you look at his ducks, you see the eyes follow you around the room. Do you notice that?
Yeah.
You get the impression, Dad, that the other eye is craning around the beak to look at you. That's a sign of a good painting, Dad. If the eyes follow you around the room, it's a good painting. If they don't, it isn't.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Pete, because I was in the bathroom the other day.
Of course you were, Dad. Oh. I remember that.
Of course I was, Pete. And I had the feeling of somebody in the room with me, you know.
Yeah.
I thought, funny, you know. You know, felt these eyes burning in the back of my head.
Funny.
So I whipped round like a flash. I see the bloody laughing cavalier up there, having a giggle. I felt so embarrassed,
didn't
you?
Of course you would, yeah. I'll tell you what's even worse, Dad, than the laughing cavalier.
What's that,
Can you think of anything worse?
No,
there is something worse than the laughing cavalier, which my Auntie Muriel has. She has the bloody Mona Lisa in her toilet, yes.
That's
dreadful, with that awful sniffy look about her, looking so superior, you know, peering down at you. She looks as if she'd never been to the lab in the life.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about the laughing cavalier. At least he has a giggle, doesn't he?
No. Yeah. Don't sit there all prissy.
No, man, you know.
Disapproving of you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Have you been down to Rubens?
No.
You haven't seen the Rubens?
No.
Just went over there.
Who's there?
Yes, lovely. He does all the fat ladies with nothing on. Great pink fat ladies.
Yeah.
Except for a tiny little wisp of gauze. Always lands on the appropriate place, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Always the wind blows a little bit of gauze over you know where, Dan.
Yeah.
See it down there,
course,
can't you?
Of course, you know, it must be a million to one chance, Pete, that the gauze, you know, lands in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
When he's painting. I bet there's thousands of paintings that we're not allowed to see where the gauze landed in the right place. Yeah.
Well, I suppose if the gauze landed on the wrong place, Dad, you know, landed on the nose or the elbow or somewhere unimportant, what Rubens did was put down his painting, went off to have lunch, probably.
Yeah.
Of course, you don't get gauze floating around in the air these days, do
you?
Like you did in Renaissance time.
No.
There's always gauze in the air in those days. Yeah.
The characters Pete and Dud, played by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, one of their skits, brought to you here on the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on KX935. Tonight, talking British comedy with British compatriot and fellow Lagoonan, Laguna Art Museum's Malcolm Warner.
When they're in the National Gallery in that skit, such a cliche about how you can tell a good painting because the eyes follow you around the room. Actually, they're talking about a popular English artist of the time called Vernon Ward, very famous for painting ducks. He was to ducks what Weiland is to dolphins and whales now. Ducks were his specialty. So they went into a discussion about how you can tell his paintings are great because the duck's eyes follow you around the room.
There's something inherently funny about ducks anyway, isn't there? I don't know why.
That's the funniest word in the English language. I read that there was a somewhat scientific study done once about how funny different sounds are to the human ear. And apparently the word duck was definitively identified as the funniest word in the English language.
There's this three ducks on the wall thing that is so working class English. I wonder what the genesis was.
Yeah, it was such a decorator's cliche. It was a big duck, a medium-sized duck, and a little duck.
I know, three of them. And they had to be on a diagonal.
Yeah, on a diagonal, so it was meant to suggest that they were getting progressively further away from you. Like, it's sort of perspective.
Oh, is that it?
But they weren't literally meant to be a big duck, a medium-sized one, or a little. They were meant to look as if the little one was a bit further away from you. Yeah.
So it wasn't evolving ducks. It was flying off ducks.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah. Why would that become a decorative thing? And, I mean, nobody from middle class on up would have ever done that in their house.
It was a thing.
It was a declarative statement. I am working class. I'm a duck person. You are tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and I'm here with Malcolm Warner, the director of Laguna Art Museum, talking about
the comedic influences of our youth in England, the shows we watched and the kind of stuff we grew up with, and this three ducks on a wall thing that's a working class decorative tradition that was mysterious to me. I had to look up and see if I could find out what it was all about. It seems that there was an English pottery factory at Stoke-on-Trent, the Beswick factory, and in 1938 they started producing these ducks as well as other birds, but the mallards seemed to be the most popular in a variety of sizes, and they were affordable. Where it really took off as a decorative tradition was that they appeared on the wall in Coronation Street, in Hilda Ogden's home. Coronation Street was a wonderful soap opera of Malcolm's and my generation, set in a working-class town near Manchester in the north of England. I think even the royals loved watching it. Anyway, let's get back to fellow Brit, Malcolm Warner, who is the director of the Laguna Art Museum here in town.
So did you go into art because you loved it, or did you just see it as a career, or what was...
Yeah, well, I didn't study it in high school at all, but that may have been the reason I liked it so much, is because it seemed like an alternative to me, because I came across it in the form of art books, not so much going to museums, for example, but art books. I liked the local library. I'd go there on Saturdays, the local public library in my hometown, and discovered art by just picking up the occasional art book from there and taking it out for a week. Yeah, it was the serious books about art that I accidentally came across in the local library that got me started. Yeah.
Were your parents art collectors?
No.
Were they interested in art?
No. No, we didn't have any art at home. Yeah, I grew up in this pretty much a working class community in Aldershot where it wasn't normal to take an interest in art. I mean, probably a lot of my parents' friends had the three ducks on the wall, actually. Anyway, that was the kind of cultural world I grew up in. It was English working class. So it was a bit of an escape for me, actually, because, to be honest, my hometown was a little bit kind of grey and dismal. So looking at art books with all these wonderful pictures of, like, sunny scenes in France painted by the Impressionists, looking back on it now, I realise that it was a one way to another world. I liked art books because there wasn't so much to read. You could pore over the pictures, and that's what I liked.
Were you dyslexic?
No, not dyslexic. I think I just had a preference for getting my information and entertainment from images, maybe rather than words. Yeah, I think some people are one way and some people are the other. My wife Sarah is much more attuned to things she hears. For me, it's things I see.
But music, you like music.
Yeah. We had a blues club at my school. I love blues music, thanks to this very enlightened teacher who ran the blues club for the boys. And one of my favourite bands is the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band from the sort of 60s going into the 70s. One thing I loved about the Bonzo Dogs was that they straddled these two worlds because they were great musicians. I mean, to be that funny with music, you have to be really good at it. And they're great comedians and kind of a musical equivalent to Monty Python. It was their excellence in those two spheres, I think, that we liked. Especially this one album called Gorilla that had the Monty Python level humour in it combined with great music. Bonzo Dogs, related in different ways to the Beatles too. I mean, you know, when you think about the Beatles, there's a kind of element of vaudeville comedy in some of their songs. So it's not totally unnatural. I think there are all kinds of social connections between the Bonzo Dogs and the Beatles too. When Eric Idle did that parody of the Beatles called The Ruttles, the music was composed by Neil Innes, who was one of the main guys in the Bonzo Dogs.
That final note, you might have mistaken it for them, right? But that was a parody of the Beatles via Monty Python composer Neil Innes for the parodying band The Ruttles. That concludes KX935's The Sharon Hour, tonight dedicated to many of the scions of British comedy who made it over here. Do make sure to keep comedy in your life, whether it's English or American comedy that tickles your fancy, or Polish, or Farsi, or Dutch, though the English are best. Thank you, Malcolm Warner, for sharing this Sharon Hour with me tonight on Laguna's one and only public FM radio station, KX935. If you want to hear the show again, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. And do come back again for more topics, chats and songs every Sunday night at 6. This is Sharon James of KX935's The Sharon Hour, wishing you a great week ahead.
The English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest.
Did you think about America when you were young? Did you think that you'd end up here?
Yeah, I had all kinds of images in my mind of America that were mostly pretty appealing. In my heart of hearts, I really loved almost everything that came out of America.